Greetings, friends. This is a recording of the Truth of Happiness course, Week 8, Tuesday class discussion and Q&A on integrating Shamatha Vipassana meditation in the context of the Four Noble Truths and the broader framework of the Eightfold Path. This is a recording of our Sangha discussion and Q&A on dependent origination and was recorded in Frenchtown, New Jersey on February 2nd, 2016. Well, good evening, everyone. We're on week 9 of our Dhamma study, and I'll introduce the five clinging aggregates this week, and that will be our study. But last week I introduced dependent origination, so let's discuss that. And what's most important about that is, and I know I've said it quite a few times, is that it is what the Buddha awakened to. From ignorance to 12 causative links, suffering arises, delusion arises, confusion arises, our less than satisfactory life arises from that ignorance, and that it's a very specific type of ignorance. It's not a general ignorance. We're not ignorant just because we're human beings. In fact, we're incredibly intelligent because we have the ability to develop as fully mature, awakened human beings, and that's once we overcome that very specific ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. So I'd like to hear if you get that, if you understand how that fits, and then how dependent origination relates to that, to the Four Noble Truths, specifically the First Noble Truth, that there is suffering, there is dukkha. We'll start with Ram. Ram, good to see you.
Yeah, I was thinking about that earlier. I found the dependent origination easier to get to understand when I just picked a spot to get into it. Over the summer I had an occasion to be, you know, on a beach, and it was so I got into, so here is, you know, pleasurable sensations, you know, seeing nice looking people, and how does that develop on the dependent origination? And I could reasonably see that, yeah, the step from here to from pleasurable sensations to desire, that's a pretty easy one to see. And to then go from there to, you know, contact with the senses,
yeah,
there's another one. Step back, but it became pretty quickly clear how this delude itself was a big chunk of that, just view of self is one thing, view of the body, you know, that part of rupa is another part that just came up as you start,
yeah,
looking into this interplay between the senses and the mind that's behind it. At that point, dependent origination became pretty clear to see.
Okay.
Couldn't follow it all the way through to like birth and death and all that, but to tease it apart at this point was very interesting.
Yeah, and as the body as the self-identified vehicle for having just experience, whatever that might,
mm-hmm,
be, is the important point. That's what's leading to tonight's talk on the five clinging aggregates, because it is the five clinging aggregates that are the impersonal vehicle for having a less than satisfying experience and a less than satisfying life. So that's a great lead into tonight's talk. Thank you. Frank,
good
how are
to be
you?
Here tonight.
Good to see you.
I feel like I'm trying to play catch up with the reading. It's a lot to take in, but I feel like I can understand how dependent origination and the 12 causative links and the five clinging aggregates are connected in a sense where the non-self is always trying to establish itself in an impermanent environment in the world. It's always changing. And I feel the meditation has allowed me to interrupt the conditioned thinking. It's like the five senses are kind of like running in all different directions. And if I don't take the time to meditate and focus on the breathing, I feel like I'm being pulled apart. And it's a way for me to like kind of tether them to my like soul.
Yeah.
And I really seen it this week in social media, having young children, you know, young adults, and young people that work for me. I saw how making permanent comments in a constantly evolving environment causes a lot of confusion, stress amongst young people and adults. I saw it. And I learned that respect, kindness, and gratitude are not inherent traits that they're taught. You know, so I had a lot of lessons this week with different things from the people I interact with. Anyway, just
working well, huh? Yeah, I'm glad you're here.
Thank you.
Thanks. Stefan, I know you've been away, but how's your Dhamma study going so far?
I don't know how to characterize it. I'm sorry I missed last week's talk, because in the reading and in general, I find that the dependent origination to be the hardest part to understand intellectually, and the hardest to relate to anything that I've experienced directly. Some of the pieces along the way make sense to me, and actually I appreciate what Ram said, because I had a very similar experience at a resort 3 weeks ago, you know, sort of watching what was going on and kind of noticing what was going on in my mind in Buddhist terms. So I do think I have experiences of noticing myself, you know, seeing or hearing something and immediately attaching that judgment to it, like dislike or like, and then that right after that there's the desire either to sort of like add the thing to your sense of self or push it away. So I kind of get that, but there are several of these links in dependent origination where I'm not really sure what specific experience the Buddha's referring to, and so I'm not quite sure how to get a hold of those parts.
But it's, I mean, you're right that it's difficult to penetrate dependent origination entirely, especially at first. Tonight's teaching will help a little bit because it'll put into perspective what it is that is experiencing this. And then as you deepen your as we all deepen our understanding of the Eightfold Path and deepen our concentration, then each factor becomes a little bit more clear. But it is something we build on. Ananda was kind of bragging to the Buddha one day about dependent origination. He says, I got dependence, nothing. And the Buddha admonished him, saying it's very, very deep. And he knew that Ananda had a ways to go yet. He says, it's very, very deep. Don't take this lightly. This is the essence of the teaching. So everything else that we've learned so far is kind of pointing towards seeing how this works, but it takes a while to develop a complete understanding of it. When I first came across dependent origination, I think like most people, the way it's usually presented, not the clarity that's in the Pali Canon, it was just nonsense, and I took it as something, well, this really isn't important. But I looked at it that way because I couldn't understand it.
Yeah.
Good, thank you. Anthony.
I went through the chapter, probably not as intensively as I should, but I understood the five clinging aggregates a little better than dependent origination. And I feel like in my own life that I'm conscious of the balance between work-life, you know, work-life balance, between the being and the doing, or the form and the formless, is pretty well in check. And when when things are going on, I can feel a bigger spaciousness in the background, and the spaciousness gets bigger, and I'm less reactive to things. And I think that that's opened up a more creative channel for me, because for a long time, I've been thinking that there's some higher purpose I need to accomplish, like something I need to do, and it's getting stronger. And I think that has to do with me recognizing the form and not getting bound up with identifying in things, because it got to the point where I said, all right, well, I'm just going to start taking classes to see what I can do, and then I kind of envisioned a marriage of something that I'm trained to do with something else, and I was just going to like apply for a master's to do a counseling degree or something. Well, you can't really do that. You got to like analyze everything, and then the right thing will sort of pop up. So I feel like the practice and being more opening up that creative channel in me is making me more willing to explore options for my future in a way that isn't clinging, because I'm not, I keep practicing law. I just want to get out of this and do something. No, I don't know how. It may take 5 years, it may take 10 years, but I just feel like the practice in general has opened up that channel in me where I want to do something more beneficial to society, more rewarding.
More meaningful.
More meaningful.
I mean, I talked to quite a few people this week, online students, about as you deepen your understanding of the Dhamma, the things you do in your life just have much more meaning. Another way of saying it is just not wasting time doing silly things, but life becomes incredibly meaningful when we understand what we're doing here. And just to relate what you said back to dependent originates, they kind of tie it together. And you're talking about the quality of your life is improving. You feel like there's more spaciousness in your life because you're developing an understanding of the Four Noble Truths. So your stress, your suffering, your distraction is lessened. And it is, for most people, a very gradual training, but that's the experience of developing the direct understanding. So remember, dependent origination explains something. It explains what happened to us. And so as we deepen our understanding of what happened to us, we can start inclining our minds towards a more authentic reality for ourselves. And that's the result of it. You
know? And it's kind of a fun journey.
That's great.
Because you don't have anywhere to go in any timetable. So it's just fun being out there exploring, seeing what options are open.
Yeah, unless you're Bahia, then you better get to it.
Unless I'm what?
Unless you're Bahia. Remember, he became enlightened, and the next step he got trampled by a cow. don't
Well, I don't spend a lot of time around cows. Yeah.
Thank you, Anthony. Liz, how are you?
I'm doing well. I've spent the last 2 days at the computer trying to write an artist statement, which has a lot of eyes in it, And so it's been interesting because I'm just looking at it from a different perspective and realizing how unattached I am to artist statements. So I'm struggling with the writing, but there's a lot of things in it that are kind of crossing over with what we've been learning here, and it's been really helpful. I'm gonna listen because I'm still, I hear what Ron was saying. Frank was saying, and so I'm here to listen today because I'm still not quite getting it. So.
I'm glad you're here. Helen, good to see you.
I don't really have anything to add tonight.
I'm glad you're
here.
Good, thank you. Don, good to see you.
Understanding of where my ego self resides in this fluctuating universe is really becoming more clear. If that makes any sort of sense.
Yeah.
I heard the word contact tonight. That was another word in there that really got me thinking. Making visual contact, making auditory contact, making, tasting, those five senses somehow connecting with this entity that I call myself, is I was thinking the words two words that came into my head tonight was, you know, nurture nature, and you know, what is it that I came in with, and what is it I'm developing, and how is all this affecting that? And I think it is in a very satisfying way. And my meditation, I see my meditation change a bit.
How so?
Not drastically.
If I can put you on the spot.
I see the purpose of it. I see that.
In the broader framework of what we're doing.
In a broader sense, I can see how concentration and focus are important in developing any of this. And the reason why concentration and focus is emphasized.
Yeah, it's so important. Thank you for sharing that. And to get back to contact, there's nothing in that these 12 causative links that are bad or evil or wrong. It's what we do with them. So contact, and this question came up a couple weeks ago online. It's not that contact is bad or something. It's what we do with it. So self-referential contact that we use to continue eye-making simply leads to more delusion. And that's the proper way to look at it. So an awakened human being has contact with the world through physical senses. Take the word there out. Through physical senses. But no eye-making is done. No self-referential fabrications are formed by that. It's simply what's occurring, what we keep pointing back to in these classes and in the Dhamma. It's simply being present moment by moment as life occurs without any self-referential thinking, without any clinging or craving or any of that stuff. So I wanted to make the point that the dependent origination describes how suffering arises, but each step is not something evil or bad or wrong. It's what we do with it. If we're going to be living in the world, and the point of that is that we can supplant ignorance with wisdom of the Four Noble Truths. Right? It depends what we do with phenomena in the world. Mary Beth, good to see you. Thank you. It's great progress. That insight into meditation as the tool for deepening concentration within this framework is so important. That's why we do it. I told myself I wasn't going to talk a lot during this session, so we don't go too long. So thank you for that. Gail, how are you? Nice to see you. one of my favorite profound statements. You can't know what you don't know till you let go of what you do know.
Yeah.
But it's true.
Read it, and I get it. Like, I think you have to do a lot of this to
feel,
to understand.
Yeah.
It.
You do. Yeah. It. Again, that's why the Buddha presented a path and didn't just say, guess what, you're all ignorant, and, you know, went to Nepal. He told us why, and he told us how to end that ignorance. That's what this is all about. Beginning with a meditation practice that develops concentration, not escape, not visions, you know, not anything else. It's just a practical tool.
Also, I was kind of rushed the other morning, and I was taking a shower, and I was thinking about, you know, being late and releasing the energy, and then I was aware of all these thoughts in my head and thinking of the future, so I thought, okay, so what do I replace that with? And I thought, oh, the shower, it was really good. The shower, but I felt the warmth of it, and, like, I think it was the nicest I ever really felt in the shower, because I never really took the time to feel it.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, so that's being in the moment, you're not missing what you're doing, but you're also, that's a way to get rid of all the other things.
Yeah, that's great. Even a shower has meaning when you're present for it.
Yeah, even
a and if you're not, it's just something to get through,
yeah,
to get to the next thing.
Those, you know, worrying about, you know, at least for that.
That's such a perfect example of what this is about. It seems so silly to focus the Dhamma on having a nice shower, but that's really what it's about. It's about being present in our lives and appreciating what's occurring. A nice warm shower, isn't this wonderful? Instead of where we have to be in 5 minutes, you know, or what happened 10 minutes ago.
I noticed, like, with the storm, and, you know, everybody said, oh, it's so cold out today. Oh, well, that's now. And I'm like, okay, well, like, it, nothing, you know, it all seems okay.
Yeah.
You know, I'm more content with everything, you know, whatever's going on.
Yeah. Thank you. Bonnie, how are you? It's good to see you.
Good to be here. All right. Trying to, what I'm working on, keeping my gyroscope righted in the midst of lots of stress and work pressures. So, how to take care better so that, to take me out of the mix so that I, you know, between being really tired physically. Then, you know, all the other things get hooked in. So I see how everything is like, I don't want to say it's like a house of cards, because I think once I really understand the tenets of them, they're like stones, or everything does build on itself. And so, yeah, I'm just needing to be really present where I'm at and not make it worse by doing what maybe I used.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. To me, the beauty of the Dhamma, you know, I'm talking kind of about the three refuges now too. Life is difficult. That's part of the First Noble Truth. Our jobs at times are very difficult, and it's important that we maintain the Eightfold Path in difficult times, meaning that we do the best we can in any situation. But the most important thing, and what needs our greatest effort, is awakening, because there's nothing more important. So no matter how difficult the day was, we can always come back to the Dhamma and nourish ourselves in the Dhamma. And that's really what this practice, that's one of the reasons why the second sit is so important. I know it's difficult for many people to incorporate a second sit, but that's the time to start nourishing ourselves and get away from all of that stuff and bring our minds back into the Dhamma, back into the peace of life as life unfolds, no matter what's occurring. And thank you for bringing that up. Rick, how are you?
Good. I'm still just trying to absorb it all and grasp it all. And, you know, a lot of it still doesn't make sense, so I'm just focusing on trying to do what I do understand. I attach myself to stuff, cling to stuff, like it is the same deal as I used to get. It's helping out.
Yeah. Are you getting an understanding of just how it fits together, or you know that it's more than just meditation?
Yeah. Absolutely.
It's more than just a positive point of view. There's some things to do. But, yeah.
In these last couple of chapters are long, so that's the part where it's slowly coming.
Good. Thank you. Lisa, it's good to see you.
Yeah, it's very good to be here, John. I'm not going to say much since I'm feeling extremely out of the loop. It's been a long time, and I didn't get to the reading I wanted to do while I was away. So I'm enjoying listening and looking forward to listening a little longer and sitting. So thanks for being here.
I'm glad you're here tonight. Lorna, how are you? Good to see you.
Good to be here. I also know that I have much to say. Read the article, and I must admit, every time I revisit it, I get something more out of it, and I understand it a little bit better.
Oh, that's great.
But I can't seem to, although I understand it when I'm reading it and absorbing it at the time, I can't seem to relate it into my life yet, or recognize things in my life that pertain to it. So I would always say a long way to go.
Thank you. The this time with dependent origination is better than the first time.
Very much.
The first time Lorna, you don't mind if I say this,
no.
The first time Lorna went through dependent origination, Lorna comes to the Wednesday night class, she threw a shoe at me. Not really. She would have liked it. But to make the point, it takes a while. You got to look at these things a few times. Again, the important thing about dependent origination is that it says that from ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. And then you can follow this chain if you want to. If you don't, you don't really have to. I mean, dependent origination is not something that was taught to the Buddha and he awakened then. Somebody taught me dependent origination. It's his understanding of awakening and what was lacking in his life. I didn't understand the Four Noble Truths. I was lacking wisdom of the true nature of life in the phenomenal world. And then he taught what that is in the Four Noble Truths. And he taught the reason why we develop such confusion, delusion, and suffering in our lives. Because we don't understand what's occurring. And it really is that simple. We don't understand what's occurring. And we don't understand the vehicle that's having the experience. In other words, we don't understand who we are. And that's what the five clinging aggregates are about. But I want to mention something. I got a really nice, another nice email about how much an online student is getting from this course. And I wanted to bring it, and I left it on my desk. But he said in a few lines, Tony. Say hello to Tony.
Hello, Tony.
Hey, Tony. He's going to get a kick out of that. Tony's out in Wyoming. And he said that this last discussion from last Tuesday night, I think it was from last Tuesday. It might have been this past Saturday. That this discussion was so good and so helpful to him. And the interaction of the Sangha, he said something like, even if you weren't there, it would have been a great class. So I didn't quite know how to take that, but thank you anyway, Tony. It really is remarkable. I get so many comments like that about the discussions and how helpful they are. So it's actually the 10th week, but the 9th week in the book, and I'll introduce karma. And I'm going to call it karma because people seem to be getting confused when I say comma, and they think that I mean that. I'll introduce karma and rebirth this week. But I'd like to hear how your study has gone this past week on dependent origination, and most importantly, how that teaching fits in with the broader context of the Four Noble Truths, and how the Eightfold Path helps us to develop an understanding. And also, going back to that, how it is ignorance of the Four Noble Truths that leads to the 12-link chain of dependencies that ends up in confusion and suffering. And if you don't see that, that's okay. That's what the practice is about. But I'd just like to hear how you're at, and I'll start with Kevin. Kevin, good to see you.
Good to see you too, John. Grateful to be here and grateful for all the teachings. My practice has been consistent.
Please come in.
Yeah. Been traveling, but trying to sort of keep up with the readings. it's pretty clear to me that, you know, ignorance and lack of understanding of the Four Noble Truths and you know, sort of, that sort of is, you know, through the 12 links, the birth of an ignorant moment. If we're not accepting of the Four Noble Truths, then we're living our lives in this state which we think is normal, we perceive it as to be normal, or, you know, you can go down the links of dependent origination, and then you're clinging to one of the five aggregates, so it's pretty easy to see how you'd be confused and delusional and maybe unhappy. But when you really accept those truths, and, you know, you can have the birth of an awakening moment and the birth of the path, and you know, then the Eightfold Path comes into play. I mean, you know, I keep finding myself skipping ahead of the reading, so I won't go to the next chapter. But it definitely, you know, that right view is so important, and you know, understanding our own ignorance, and that just will build on dependent origination, five clinging aggregates, and then this week's talk. I'm really finding a lot of clarity with that, and then, you know, further right intention to abandon all clinging and craving, and yeah, that's the birth of sort of this awakened moment, and you'll probably talk about it in a few minutes with Karma.
So I will.
It's just great, and it's I think, you know, what I have found is that one thing you say in the end of your chapters, rarely will something be more important than your practice, and I know that sometimes is easier to say than to actually do, but, you know, sort of that goes back to right intention. If you have the intention to sit every day with you know, an open mind and an open heart, you're setting the intention for abandoning all clinging and craving, and I just wouldn't be here or where I am and understanding this all and developing that without that consistency. So I find that I just have to do it. I have to sit, you know, whether it's I'm going to be a couple of minutes late, well, then I'm going to be a couple of minutes late because this is where it is. This is more important. There's nothing more important than this right now for me. And life's pretty crazy, so I find the time sometime in the morning to do it. I'm still not gentle because I can't get the evening ones down yet, but maybe this week I'll get that back. So just thankful for that.
Well, thank you for what you just said. You described how dependent origination fits into the overall framework beautifully, and of course I think that the most important thing any of us can do is take to the Dhamma and awaken. It will solve all the difficulties in the world.
One quote I was thinking of was Lao Tzu, and it said, "The greatest gift you can give is your own self transformation."
Yeah,
that's what this is.
Yeah, it is. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome. Hi, I'm John.
Hi, I'm Michelle.
Oh, hi, Michelle. It's nice to see you. Jen,
hi.
Good to see you. Welcome. So we're talking about dependent origination and how it fits into the overall framework. And how was your last week's study?
It was nice. I've been feeling kind of dovetailing on what you were saying. Just a very like a lot of gratitude for this practice, and seeing that how. It really is just the bottom line. I had a presentation that I was doing at work this week, and it was something that I had been planning for 2 months, and it's something that was I felt very strongly about how helpful it was and valuable for my colleagues, and I was thinking about it often, but this practice was very helpful as I went through that to keep putting down my own kind of wants for whatever outcome, putting down my own thoughts about what I thought people should be thinking or doing with this information, and it just created such a great, when I actually did the presentation yesterday, it created such a great exchange with all of my colleagues, and it set this tone for everybody to be
realistic and present and kind of focused and concentrated on what we needed to do instead of what we were stressed out about. And that was so valuable. It was this practice that helped me kind of, you know, be in that space. And I realized that just me being that way kind of, it's just like when we come here, nobody's complaining, nobody's, you know, just whining. It's just constructive. And when you kind of are in that space, like I just kept trying to just be that in that space and just not worry about everybody else. And it was just helpful to do that because I realized that, like, if you do that, other people kind of do the same thing. So you just don't have to worry about everybody else.
Yeah.
So it was, that was me, like, continually putting down my own ego, continually seeing it come up in everything as I was trying to plan my presentation, just continually putting it down. So that was, yeah. I'm trying to relate that back to the kind of origination other than it's just seeing my own ego. Yeah.
Yeah. That's it. That's the practical application of the understanding. As we diminish craving and clinging, we cease clinging to other people, which means we stop creating speculative expectations of things and how we want things to be. And we just, you know, another kind of a new age term, we just stay centered in what's occurring and what we're doing. And that openness allows the freedom for everyone to just be with us, what we do here. Why complain? Why whine? Why worry? You know, and the few people that do complain, I throw them right out. Thank you. David, how are you? Good to see you.
I'm doing good. Had some confusion about someone that asked me about the Eightfold Path. Because your right livelihood and your right speech could become part of an ego self if you choose to find yourself that way. But I guess what the Buddha was saying is that if you do have a right livelihood and you practice right speech, that you just have less stress in your life. He's not saying that you should define your ego self and include those aspects of it.
Yeah. I think that's a great insight. And there's a reason why the Eightfold Path is presented the way it's presented. If we fully develop right view, and initially right view is the understanding that I don't have a penetrating understanding of the Four Noble Truths, and I'm going to engage in the Dhamma to accomplish that. And that leads directly to right intention, which is the intention to recognize and abandon all craving and clinging. And as we deepen that, we will cease creating identities out of the next moral and ethical factors of right speech, action, and livelihood. In other words, I'm not becoming a better Buddhist because I'm engaged in right view. I'm not creating an identity of that. It's just simply a natural expression of my understanding now. And it's a subtle difference, but it's important. It's important to recognize. We can easily get caught up in being the perfect Dhamma practitioner. But that's just another view that's going to lead us to more stress and suffering. But if we're well grounded in right view and right intention, then as we're engaged in the wrong aspects of the moral and ethical behaviors, we'll recognize it and abandon it. So we can overemphasize and create an identity of being engaged in the whole Dhamma. And that's just going to lead to more stress and suffering. But if we recognize it through right view and right intention, what we're doing, which we will, then it doesn't occur. But it takes a while. I mean, it's rather comforting at first when we come to the Dhamma and say, well, now I'm a Buddhist. Of course, the Buddha never called himself a Buddhist, and he never tried to start a religion. He tried to teach us, and he was very successful, a way to recognize and abandon all craving and clinging. to become unbound from those types of things. So it's a great insight. Thank you for bringing it up. Mike, welcome to our Sangha. I know you're just starting out, and we're in the middle of this course, but how has your practice been the last... Mike and I met a week ago, and Mike started on his meditation practice. How has that been going, and do you have any questions for how this all fits together?
Not so far, thanks. Like I said, you know, it's taking it at 3 minutes a time.
Yeah.
It's literally blown by in my head. Just all of a sudden, I even have a timer on my phone that goes off for 3 minutes. I felt like 30 seconds.
Yeah, that's good.
So, yeah, that's... and I think just acknowledging the thoughts that pop into my head. As I mentioned, you know, I've tried this before and haven't had any success. And I think in the past, I tried to push them away. By not doing that and saying, oh, okay, I'm thinking about my responsibility for first thing tomorrow morning with work.
Yeah.
All right, there it is, and going back to my breathing.
That's it?
It's been very helpful thus far.
Yeah. And so as you progress, then you'll start integrating the things that we're talking about. And I know I mentioned it to you that meditation, Shamatha Vipassana meditation, is only one factor of eight, and it's important to develop all of that together. But, you've got a great start, so I'm glad you're here. Diane, it's good to see you.
Thank you. Thank you for steadfastly being here and having this.
You're welcome. It's too cold to be anywhere else.
one of the things that I've become aware of is one day, it's like the whole day is in light. It's just beautiful. And I don't have any clinging or craving. And then the next day, it's like monster ego infiltrates absolutely every cell of my life. And I think, where was yesterday? What happened? And my neurotic thing is, what did I do wrong? And it's happened frequently enough that I'm beginning to laugh at it because I know it's ego wanting to come back in and take, you know, control again and swoop down and whatever. And that has been one of the most sane producing things in my life. I'm just so grateful for it, to recognize that when that horrible, those horrible, insecure, doubting feelings, whatever, want to rise up and consume and say, you stupid jerk, kind of dialogue, and I can say, oh, hi, thanks for stopping by, see you later, and just because of that wonderful spaciousness inside of me now that's, you know, unnameable, indescribable. I can be kind to ego or whatever that those voices are and let them go. And it's just, it's like, sometimes I do get into ego and I think, just the whole world really needs to know this feeling, because this is so fabulous. This is so free, and I don't know at this point that anything in my life is solved the way I would like it to be, but I can take one moment at a time and trust that I'm doing exactly what I'm meant to do, and be okay with it.
Thank you. You just gave a great teaching on the seventh week on anicca, anatta, and dukkha, and how they're all intertwined. One day you're having a very pleasant, wonderful day, and the next day it's not so much, and you're clinging to yesterday. Mm-hmm. Why? How come today isn't part of anicca? And because of some self-identification, it creates that dukkha. You just took that whole teaching and gave a very practical explanation, And as you come back to the understanding that you've developed, peace arises. You know? In fact, that's kind of what we're talking. Jen was talking about it too. The whole point of this, the whole point of what the Buddha taught, is to develop lasting peace and happiness right now in our lives. Not in some future life, not in some mystical plane, right here, right now. It's the most practical teaching that's ever been given to us. Thank you for sharing that. Mark, good to see you. How are you?
Well, this last week has been, a couple of people have talked about things that made me think about it. My practice is going well as far as consistency, but I've found in the last week that I've struggled with concentration. I'm kind of redoubling my efforts with right intention. And really trying to, as I'm meditating, focus on my breath, allow thoughts to come up, but really put in the intention to return to my breath. So, because I found that I was kind of drifting along, following my thoughts, and not coming back to my breath. And I had some moments where I came to that realization, and I'm like, wow, okay, that's interesting. Try to be gentle and realize I know what the right action is to take, and then to try to take it. And that has really been helpful in referring back to the Eightfold Path throughout this last week. I could see this last week in the past being one where I would potentially get wrapped up in a lot of what is going on around me and spiraling maybe out of control. And I haven't done that. I've found myself checking in and being mindful of mine. Seeing where my state of mind is, checking in on what is the speech that I'm using, mostly my own dialogue in my head, to see if it is right speech. So I'm just very thankful for the Eightfold Path as well, because it's allowed me to recognize in a seemingly not so great week, which is all created by myself anyway, but how to return back to a peaceful state of mind. So I'm just continuing to do that, and I know it will be okay because of impermanence, as you said. I know it will change. So it's just a matter of being consistent and staying on the path.
Yeah. Thank you. Again, it's just another remarkable insight in how this works and how the framework and the guidance of the Eightfold Path is truly that. It guides our awakening. It keeps our mind inclined towards awakening and away from continued confusion and delusion. The way you describe having the intention to come back to your breath is the perfect application of right intention, because when we're following our thoughts, what is that? It's attachment to our own thinking process. It's clinging to our thoughts. And that's where we continue to establish an ego personality that's prone to confusion and suffering. When we maintain that right intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging, it comes into our meditation practice in that very direct way. We recognize that we're attached to our thoughts, come back to the sensation of breathing. And that very simple but profound action is the essence of the Dhamma. It's the essence of developing concentration. It's why meditation, a right meditation practice, is so important as the foundation for the entire Eightfold Path. But the rest of the path gives you that understanding that I'm engaged in a wrong intention right now, and my intention is to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. It works perfectly. Thank you. Eva, how are you? It's good to see you.
This week, I have put the realization of how important meditation and what I am practice, how important it is in my life, and how I do understand this. He said, Kevin said, yes, of realizing that really it is the most important thing, and that I value the time that I do put towards it and see how important it is to my overall day and life. And it's added an excitement. excitement to my life that, you know, I had, I guess, before had a more negative look towards the future with the whole way things were. And I don't feel that as much because by taking care of myself and opening up to all this other information or way of being, I feel different, and I do feel that I am affecting a change in others. That I know that in other things that I tried to do, where I'm going to be part of this group, and I'm going to, you know, we're going to all do this together, and it doesn't happen that way. And then you become disappointed, and now I don't feel that sense of disappointment, and I see that I have reason not to feel that sense of disappointment. It's wonderful. And as far as reading the book is concerned and all that, it's become very intellectual to me, you know, and I'm like trying to understand what this means and trying to analyze. And so I realized that the best thing was kind of to let it go and to just kind of let it, you know, I read it and I'll read it again, and I understand the importance of repetition because, you know, I thought I knew all that stuff and then I forgot, you know, you say these things, you know, you name them, and I'm like, what are they? You know, I don't really know, but I feel comfortable in knowing that by just kind of opening up to it and sitting in it, stewing in it, that it does start going to where it belongs, and then, you know, point A can sort of follow point B. So I'm very happy.
Thank you. Thank you. Anything that we come across that's new to us, we engage with it intellectually. We have to learn it somewhere. We have to get the general idea. But the Dhamma itself is to be experienced. And the only thing that I can do, the only thing that the Buddha's teachings can do, is point us in the right direction and give us a context to develop our own understanding. And that's really what the Eightfold Path is about, too. As we develop our deepening understanding, we can weigh our thoughts, words, and deeds against the Eightfold Path, and we continue in the right direction. And we have most people have these little mini awakenings, little bits of it. We see how it fits in with the rest of it. And pretty soon we're able to put together the whole package. And we have that awakening experience, which is nothing more than fully maturing as a human being. We learn how to live in the world in the most effective way. Thank you. Michelle, welcome. Forgive me, I can't remember if you've been with us before.
I've never been here before.
So welcome to our Sangha. Do you have a meditation practice now?
I just have recently started. And so I'm very, very beginner. I know somebody that I guess attends the Tuesday night class, and I was intrigued, so I thought I would take a ride out.
Well, I'm glad you did. So we're in the middle of a course. It's perfectly appropriate for you to be here. The only reason I say that is if you're confused by some of the things we're talking about, you just haven't had the foundation yet for understanding that. But if you keep coming, you will. I teach a very simple but profound meditation method called Shamatha Vipassana. There's a yellow booklet out there. Please take it, and it describes this in a little bit more detail than I will today. But just for today, just understand that meditation alone is not likely to develop to develop you fully, but it's taught within a wider framework that's very easy to integrate into your life, and that's kind of what we're talking about today. So when we get to meditate, we'll meditate for 20 minutes today. I'll talk you into it, and Mike's been doing it for a while. The most important thing I can tell you, and I say it often, is be very gentle with yourself. Don't judge yourself harshly or the practice, but if you engage in it, like Mike was talking about, if you're just starting out, start with 2 or 3 or 4 minutes a day, and if you can do that twice a day, be part of a sangha, and pretty soon you'll have a full-fledged meditation practice. So, welcome to our sangha. I'm glad you're here. Ellie, how are you? Good to see you.
I'm good. My meditation this week's been more distracted than usual, but that's just the way it is right now, I guess. But on the other hand, regarding what Eva was saying about intellectually understanding the teachings,
like I was thinking about all this when I decided to think about it. And I would look at it intellectually and try and apply it to what was going on and figure things out. But recently what's happening is that I'm starting to see things without making that effort through that same lens. Just in the course of the day when I'm talking to people at work, it's kind of the lens dropping over how everything else is unfolding, which is interesting and very helpful.
Yeah. You're seeing life clearly.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it really is that basic, but that's also very remarkable.
I'm trying not to say anything to people.
Yeah.
Because they could get really obnoxious, I think. Oh, but you know.
Yeah, that's an aspect of right speech, too.
You can accept that without approving. Not saying anything.
What?
I have a special face for noble silence in that. It's like weird, like, bitter grimace, like.
That's part of right. It has to be useful.
Right.
If it's likely to fall on deaf ears, you keep your mouth shut. Because it just entangles us deeper. But you want to help. You want to, when you see people caught up in that approval, acceptance thing, you want to point out to them. But
especially because you've been there or you're in it. Or,
yeah. And the only way is by example, because then you might get people interested in why are you this way? Why are you so peaceful and happy in the midst of all this? You know, there used to be, I was dating a girl years ago, and I think it's what led to our breakup, but sitting down at dinner one time, she says, "Why are you always smiling?" You know. And I said, "I don't know." I just am. But I do that a lot, you know. Why? I don't have a smile on my face constantly, but it's there a lot more than it used to be many years ago, you know. Why be so upset? Jen, you got something?
So a light bulb has gone off this week, and something that you just said made me think of it was, you know, being a passionate, you know, getting excited about stuff, and then I, you know, jump on what somebody else is saying, as I do in here all the time. I try not to do it, but I do it. If I can, like, just kind of, like, relax for a second and, like, let what I want kind of settle down, I see openings in other people. So if they are talking and it's all ego that's coming out, what they're saying, and it's ego, 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 then I have that opportunity to kind of reinforce their ego or,
yeah,
you know, engage in right speech and say nothing, noble silence. They kind of burn out their own ego, and then there's this space where they're open.
Yeah.
And that's when I can, like, kind of re-engage. And so that right speech practice, you start to see how communication begins to work. And it's just little glimpses that I've just seen this week, like, oh, if I just be quiet for a second, everything settles down, everybody's ego settles down, and then we can, like, be constructive again. I get it now. Otherwise, it's just my ego, and then your ego, and then my ego, and then your ego.
Yeah. War start over that process, escalating egos, escalating points of view, and we start getting very defensive. As opposed to having great restraint, which is another way of saying lack of clinging, lack of craving. Restraint of speech is one of the greatest gifts that I found. It's okay for me to keep my mouth shut. Because when I was younger, I loved argument, especially when I could end up being right. No matter how wrong I was so happy to prove myself right. And I just left myself in chaos and other people, too. Throughout the Pali Canon, there's so many stories about the Buddha just keeping his mouth shut, just sitting quiet. As when he knew that it was not going to lead to awakening, he just sat quietly. And that allows other people to start thinking about what they're saying instead of fighting with what you're saying. So Eva, you had something.
Is that then sort of dependent origination?
Yes. Yeah, it's another perfect practical example of how ignorance of the Four Noble Truths, including the Eightfold Path, leads to immediate antagonistic situations. Whereas if we develop the Eightfold Path even a little bit, we start developing restraint of speech, restraint of other actions, and we don't create the chaos and upset that we may have, you know, until we had that understanding. That's how we truly establish peace in our lives and in the world. We stop creating conflict. As we stop creating conflict in ourselves, we stop creating it outwardly also. Diane.
Sometimes stuff would come up in the morning that was so overwhelming that I started, and I would hear you echo that be gentle, and it was, I just felt like I'll just have to let this process through me and I'll be okay. And when it came time to do the second meditation of the day, I just thought that I just wasn't gonna go there. There's just too much. I can't handle it. And so that was my process for a while. I would meditate twice a day, but if stuff came up in the morning that was just, to me, humongous and difficult to process, I would forego the second meditation. And in the last several weeks, and to me this is like incredible, it's like, even though heavy stuff, you know, whatever, you know, stuff came up that was difficult, it was like I trusted and loved myself. You know, don't take those words wrong. To sit again, that it was okay. I mean, it was such a sense of peace, I guess. That I could just totally trust myself, be with myself, be intimate and value that time to go within. And it's amazing how that second meditation has really become as important as the first.
Yeah, it is. Thank you for bringing that up. The part of that meditation within the broader framework of the Eightfold Path helps develop that. As we engage in the practice wholeheartedly, meditation becomes something not so much what we must do, it's what we want to do. And we start developing an understanding of the three refuges, which I'll talk about in a couple of weeks, too. We see meditation as a real refuge from what's occurring, rather than, and not in a way that it's an escape, rather than something that we're doing because John says we should, or we want to be the good Buddhist, or whatever it is, or I'm going to class, I want to make sure I'm meditating. We do it because it's what it draws us to sit, eventually. And when we don't feel like sitting, every time we sit when we don't feel like sitting, we're diminishing our own conditioned mind's resistance to just sitting quietly. Every single time, and it starts. That's another aspect of just deepening concentration. So, thank you for bringing that up. Are there any questions or comments on dependent origination before I get into karma and rebirth? Okay.
Would you define it again? Just
dependent origination or karma? So, dependent origination is what the Buddha awakened to. Thank you for asking the question. And everything he taught, beginning with his first teaching on the Four Noble Truths, is based on this awakening. So the Buddha set out to develop an understanding and hopefully find a cure for the common cause of human disappointment and suffering. And he spent 6 years wandering around northern India, southern Nepal, studying with some of the great spiritual teachers and then practicing his own ascetic practices. And out of frustration of not developing an understanding, he decided that I am going to sit in meditation until I awaken. He had the strong resolve, the right intention to engage in Dhamma practice with that goal in mind. And so the legend is that he meditated for anywhere from one night to 40 nights. The timing is not that important. But during his meditation, he came up against every aspect of his ego personality, every aspect of craving and clinging, recognized it as such, and abandoned those. And one morning, he saw the morning star and the Buddha awaken. And what he awakened to was that he was ignorant up until that point of what he would later describe as the Four Noble Truths. What he saw was that life is inherently disappointing. No reason to fight it. That he exacerbates that and proliferates that suffering by craving and clinging. He also understood that there was a way out, that's the Third Noble Truth, and he understood that the way out of suffering, the way out of this inherent disappointing nature of human life, is a meditation practice that he had engaged with since he was a little boy, within this framework, this wider framework of seeing things clearly, recognizing and abandoning craving and clinging, engaging in moral and ethical behavior, and then the concentration factors of right effort, meaning you have to meditate, you have to develop a deeper understanding of the Eightfold Path, you have to develop a refined mindfulness, and you have to utilize right meditation. So he awakened to that we are ignorant of the Four Noble Truths. The Buddha is not saying that just because we're human beings, we're naturally ignorant. We're lacking in understanding of the Four Noble Truths, and because of that, through these observable causative links, 12 of them, we end up in a situation, or as Kevin put brilliantly before, we give birth to confusion and suffering. We do it ourselves. And so, if we can develop understanding of the Four Noble Truths, we're no longer ignorant of them, we will not give birth to disappointing and confusing aspects of life. We'll see things clearly as life occurs. So from ignorance to 12 observable causative links, we give birth to stress and suffering. Another important teaching of that is that any one of these links, when they're fully penetrated, when we fully understand them, begins to unravel that whole 12-link chain of dependencies. It's another way of describing awakening. There's a teaching where the Buddha was presenting dependent origination and describing how an awakened person achieves that, and he simply described dependent origination in reverse, showing that if you can penetrate any one of those links, you awaken. This goes back to the second half of week 8 in the 5 clinging aggregates. When we start penetrating that understanding, and it takes a little bit, we start unraveling this thing called the 5 clinging aggregates, and it's the same thing as unraveling the dependent origination. And that might be a little bit too conceptual to make sense, so I'll leave it there. But thanks for the question. Did I help?
Basically, you're saying dependent origination is life is dukkha, life is difficult.
Because of ignorance of the Four Noble Truths.
Because of ignorance, and the Four Noble Truths are that life is difficult, I forget what the second one is.
Craving and clinging originates and perpetuates.
Hang on to that. And the third, that there's a way out, and the way out is through meditation.
No, through the Eightfold Path.
And the Eightfold Path. I didn't finish the sentence.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then, and basically coming into right thinking, right thought, right intention, right livelihood, etc. And so basically, it's accepting that things are a mess and there's a way to live with it that brings lasting peace and happiness.
Yeah, I guess you could put it that way.
I'm just trying to get away from terminology more than anything, so that and to simplify it for me. So that was all.
Thank you. The Four Noble Truths describes the problem, the cause of the problem,
yeah,
and the solution to the problem.
Yeah.
And
lead to the
terminology doesn't matter too much, except that we have to use the correct terminology to understand the broader framework and understand what's really occurring here and who it's occurring to. So the Eightfold Path gives us that, the framework for developing understanding of the three marks of existence. And it seems very complicated at first, mostly because we're not familiar with the terms that are used.
The other part of it is the essential nature. I'm beginning to understand as such a, just to use adjectives, wonderful part of me that all of the dependent origination kind of smothered and I never even knew was remembered was there. And what all of this, the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path are trying to scrape away or you know, somehow dissolve away or get rid of what hid this essential nature in me that's really kind of, you know, that's not obnoxious, that's not ego-controlled, that's just a really neat thing or whatever non-thing I am. Not.
You're, even what you were calling essential nature is an aspect of Anicca. There's nothing fixed and permanent there either. And the reason why that's important is that we can get in trouble with that. That's led to some of the more modern beliefs. Well, not really so modern. I mean, there were people that wanted to claim this even during the Buddhist time. In modern Buddhism, it's in the Mahayana schools, they talk about this inner Buddha nature or an essential nature, that there's something that's part of anatta, which the Buddha said is not a self, that is inherently whatever, a Buddha. And if you look at the Buddha's teachings closely, you realize that that doesn't make any sense. If there's an inner Buddha nature that I'm seeking to achieve through this practice, and I do, how can it be so prone to confusion and suffering, and why am I chasing it? It's just another image of myself that I'm chasing.
But no,
so,
wait, that's an ego thing. That,
it is.
That
so,
needs to achieve. And what I understand you're saying is that the practice of meditation is to remove that mental block of ego
The reason why it's not helpful to believe that there's an inner essential nature or a Buddha nature within me is that that's just another view. It's just another view that I'm held.
If you put a definition to it.
Again, the reason why I'm bringing it up is it's too easy to put definitions to it. It's better to not speculate about it.
Yeah. Not think about it.
There's no reason to speculate on it. Everything, the reason, and even if we, even if there is such a thing as an essential nature within an ego personality, it's still prone to impermanence. It's still, so why hold on to it? What's most important is to recognize and abandon all craving and clinging views that seek to establish an ego personality in any realm, whether it's an outer realm, a future realm, or an inner realm, and let go of them. Because that can really make us hold on to things that we shouldn't be holding on to. It's the basic problem with the later developed schools of Buddhism. It also is a basic problem of some other belief systems too. Let go of all views. If you want to see things clearly, let go of all confused views. Because if you're holding on to a little, even a minor, seemingly minor, insignificant view that's rooted in ignorance, it can only lead to more ignorance.
That's really difficult to explain.
It is. But it can be experienced.
Yeah.
Again, that's why the framework is so important, to see these things clearly. I can say those things forever. It doesn't mean anything unless we actually experience it. I used to think that I was chasing an inner Buddha nature, an inner essential nature that was some magical cosmic something that somehow wasn't a self, but it was John. It's pretty confusing, isn't it? And it creates a lot of tension. When we're willing to let go of all views and see speculation about what I might be, because what I might be is still establishing an ego personality, then I can begin to see things clearly. Then I'm really creating spaciousness. I'm allowing for right view and the rest of the Eightfold Path to penetrate my mindfulness. And if my mindfulness is inclined towards establishing or creating an inner Buddha nature or an inner essential nature, I'm just chasing another point of view, likely. There's nothing that the Buddha ever taught or that's included in the Pali Canon or as part of the Eightfold Path that speaks to any of that.
It is such a process,
though. Now, well, that's the important point. Because of impermanence, the only thing that we can point to, and it's not the only thing that I can point to as me, the only thing that can be pointed to or understood is the process of life unfolding. Without any discriminating views, without insisting on creating a permanent identity with anything. And again, it's getting a little bit complicated and maybe I'm getting too wordy today. To understand it, and again, it's not something that can be explained. It can only be experienced. But we have to learn to stop speculating. We have to learn to recognize views that we've created and abandon every one of them. And one of the views that is very common that we create is of an inner greater being that we contain. Because that is, if you think about that, no matter how messed up I am, no matter how bad my day is or how confused I am, inside me is the greatest person. Well, what is that? That's just another establishment of an ego personality.
You can't let something go if you don't know that it's there.
Well, it's just a point of view, though.
I understand that, but that's what I'm trying to say. The process is, if you walk up to someone on the street and say, you know, you're nothing, there's nothing there, you know.
Why would you do that, though? Why would you walk up to someone and tell them that?
Well, this is just an example. Someone who's starting the journey, so to speak, you can't just annihilate them initially, or they can't.
I hope I don't do that.
I can't just annihilate everything that's in me. I mean, I'm not one of those that is an overnight miracle kind of thing. I have this process. That's because I'm old, probably, but I have this process that I have to go and the process is the layering away of all these things that said I am the greatest in there. And I think what's really cool is that it's okay. That there's
the process is okay.
The greatest even there.
Yeah.
But you can't. That's a process.
Yeah.
I mean, and the word is a really huge word. That process is a huge word that it doesn't happen without a little bit of yoga.
Yeah, well, there's times when this is a very, I used to say that this is a path of ease and joy, but it's not for the faint of heart. And it's not. But what's the end result? Understanding what's really occurring, fully maturing as a human being. And all we have to do is be willing to let go of views that arise from an ego personality. And again, that's not easy, but we're given a way to do that. It's not that somebody's saying you must do this. When the Buddha used the term anatta, he's just saying what you think you are is not it. Let go of those views, including these views of an eternal inner self. That's the biggest hang-up that all of the modern schools have, and it's the biggest hang-up that people have, whether you're involved in a so-called spiritual practice or not. You're seeking to continually establish yourself somehow, somewhere, somewhere. And as we develop a broader understanding of what's occurring, we recognize that all these views are insubstantial and should be abandoned. But it's not about annihilation. It's about fully establishing an awakened human being. When the Buddha awakened and let go of every single view, including the view that there was an inner something, he didn't vanish, he wasn't annihilated. He lived for 45 years, living the most effective life that any human being ever lived. But that question comes up often. You know, nearly, I wouldn't say every class, but many classes. If I awaken, what happens to me? Awaken. You know, you'll find out. But we don't do it alone. You know, that's one of the aspects of the three refuges. We know that a human being actually did this. He showed us a way to do it. And we can take refuge in the process that all of us are doing it right here, right now. So, again, Diane, you bring up another great question. I'm going to get to that's all right. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.